This piece was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, SurreyFarms.com.
Yeah, I was the kid from, I was 10 years old walking down the street with a transistor radio. And do you remember in Almost Famous, the one kid who was like, it was right out in front of the Gramercy Hotel, and the kid walks over and he's like, "They're here! Led Zeppelin's here! They're here!" That was me.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Tom Colicchio. Chef Tom Colicchio might be most recognized by the public as head judge on Bravo's hit reality cooking series Top Chef, but his culinary accomplishments go far beyond food television. Colicchio has worked at prominent New York restaurants such as the Quilted Giraffe, Gotham Bar and Grill, Raquel, and Mondrian. In 1994, he opened Gramercy Tavern with Danny Meyer in Manhattan's Gramercy Park neighborhood. Colicchio's cooking at Gramercy Tavern garnered 3 stars from the New York Times and earned him the James Beard Foundation's Best Chef New York Award in 2000. In 2001, Colicchio opened Kraft, another celebrated restaurant 1 block south of Gramercy Tavern. Since then, he's opened numerous additional restaurants, including Kraft Bar, Colicchio & Sons, and sandwich shop Witchcraft. He recently served as executive producer on A Place at the Table, a critically acclaimed documentary about food insecurity in America. It's no secret, Tom Colicchio is one of the hardest working men in food, and he's shown that work ethic ever since he was a child. He grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and it didn't take him long to find his career path in food.
I mean, I was most likely would have been diagnosed with ADD, and I had issues writing. I had a very hard time writing, and I also had a hard time following recipes for some reason. And there's this whole theory of output, that it's not so much the inputs of learning, it's being able to sort of get it out there. And to this day, I still have a very difficult time writing. But I think that somehow I found a career that I didn't have to write much. I didn't have to, I didn't want to. I didn't have to write cookbooks and put it off for a long time because I knew I had a problem with output. And I didn't understand this theory until recently. I found my way to cooking, and for a lot of reasons, it appealed to me. I mean, this idea that I was able to do something and accomplish it, and that, people who struggle with output have self-esteem problems because they can't seem to finish something. And so cooking, I found this one thing that I can actually start and finish very quickly and also get this immediate gratification for it. In a very short time, you put a meal together, you put it on a table, and people are like, "Oh, this is great." And so for me, I solved that output problem. This is something that I could actually do. So, looking back on it now, I understand why I was completely attracted to the process of cooking and what it did for my psyche. My dad, said, "Oh, you should be a baker. We need a good bakery in town." And that was the extent. Like, that's how far they could see. Like, "I'm going to do this in town." I think some family members, when I said, "Hey, I want to be a chef," they had this vision of some guy in a wife beater with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, stirring the gravy. But luckily for me, and I think it was a matter of timing, it was right when, American cuisine was happening. And right when, Cuisine Magazine, I remember this one issue, it was the L.A. issue. And they talked about Jonathan Waxman and Michael McCarthy and Jeremiah Tower and Alice Waters and all these people that are still in the game. But to me, it was where like food and pop culture kind of started to mesh. And it was really California. I mean, the New York restaurants were more sort of French influenced and, the Lutèce and stuff. And these guys, you looked at what was going on in L.A. and it was like, these guys were like rock stars. I mean, it was like really cool. I remember looking at this and going, "Wow, this is it, man. This is great stuff." Who knew that cooking could be so interesting and fun? I started working in restaurants, and one led to another, and at one point I was also, from the age of 18, I was living on my own, so I had to earn money. And the first restaurant, so it was probably about the fourth or fifth restaurant that I worked in, I decided to come to New York and get my resume out there, and I worked with Alfred Portale at Gotham for about a week, and only a week because Barry Wine called me from the Quilted Giraffe and said, "I want to talk to you." It was interesting because Barry never hired what he called career cooks. And I clearly was one, but he was thinking of expanding, so he knew eventually he'd have to work with career cooks. And he offered me a position. And it was the position in the kitchen that kind of ran the service. It wasn't a sous chef's position yet, but within 4 months it turned into a sous chef's position. And at that point, I'm working in a 4-star restaurant in Manhattan. I was offered a sous chef's position. I'm 24 years old. I'm not going to culinary school. I was offered a chef position at the restaurant in New Jersey where I was a sous chef, 40 Main Street. I got a call from the owner one day and said, we're thinking of the chef's leaving and we'd like to bring you back. And at the time, I was actually thinking of doing a restaurant with another friend of mine. So I said, well, we'll come back as co-chefs. And we did. And that lasted about 8 months. And then it just got a little dicey. But what it did for me, and I really thought about this, I knew that in order to make a difference, you can't copy anybody anymore. You have to do your own thing. You have to find your own style. And I didn't want to do food that I was doing a quilted giraffe, and I didn't want to do food that I had seen before or seen in a magazine. So I knew going back to New Jersey, I can kind of get out of the spotlight of New York City and work on a style. I developed a style and started developing a way of doing things. And, you know, I think a lot of technique and I think the focus came from working at Raquel with Thomas. I mean, some of the stuff that we were doing there was just really great. And, you know, it was a restaurant that didn't make it. And I think partly because it was kind of schizophrenic. You had one partner, Serge Raoul, who wanted this club scene from the bar. And then you had, you know, Thomas didn't want to do very serious food. And the two, I think nowadays it would have worked perfectly because now you have restaurants like that. You have music that's being played loud in restaurants. And back then, you couldn't do it. The clientele that came for his food didn't want to hear disco. it was kind of a schizophrenic restaurant, but the food was fabulous. And, you know, it was the first time, you know, I saw, you know, food moving to the rim, which, you know, is no longer in vogue. But, you know, back then it was like, this is pretty radical. This is pretty cool. And, I remember nights when I was working fish station, he was working meat station, and we'd have a VIP come in. It was just like, do something off the menu, do something, whatever. And I would do something, and he would do something, and go back and forth. And it was just great because it was just this just crazy free time of just like, let's try anything. But it was all based on serious, serious technique. So it all worked. Yeah. And it was just a blast. And so I think that I, just from a technical standpoint, that's where I think learn the most. I was still at Gramercy and doing the food that I was doing there, and I wanted to do a second restaurant, and it just so happened to be around the corner, and I knew I couldn't do the same food I was doing. And that was very, you know, personal food I was doing. It was a lot of dishes that I'd done for years and always retweaked them and always worked on new things, but I couldn't do that style of food. It was also at the same time when you really started hearing people talk about ingredients. It's ingredients, 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 simplicity, simplicity. And I said, all right, fine, let's just explore that. And I knew that I wanted the food to be very simple. And even as, you know, there was two things that always kind of were sort of the touch points for this. One was I wanted to go to a place where you can get a bowl of peas that were just perfect. Now, you know, in the kitchen, when peas come in season, there are times they are sweet, they're delicious, and the next day they're starchy and nasty. And yet you have a menu, and you have peas on two appetizers and an entree, and what do? You use the peas, because you have to. So I said, you know what, I want to be in a position where if those peas aren't perfect, I could just send them away and not worry about it, because it's only on a side dish. And the same thing with fish. I want to only use stuff that's perfect, and if it's not perfect, then I can turn it away. And so having this idea where I'm going to have the confidence now. I also think there's a certain evolution of as a chef where, you know, I looked at dishes that I had done for 10, 15 years and noticed that every season, if it was a spring dish, I started taking things off because I just had the confidence. I didn't need the bells and whistles anymore. And so I said, okay, let's look. What is this dish going to look like? What is this fish dish with all the bells and whistles? What is it going to look like, you know, 20 years from now? Maybe just fish. It's taken it to an extreme, obviously, but I thought this could explore this. And I thought about it and said, this is where I want to go. And then I thought about that and said, well, what is that? And to me, that was more about the craft of cooking, less the artistry. And I'm not using artistry as a bad word, but it's not about art. It's the difference between, you know, finding a Shaker table versus like a more ornate style of table. You know, it's still a table, but it's simple. And this idea of simplicity was something that I really wanted to find. boy, it scared the hell out of me because I was like, God, what if everybody hates this? And we kind of took it to an extreme when we first opened up, and then we didn't pare it back, but we pared back some of the categories. But, you know, it was really funny because about 6 months after opening Craft, Cyril Maccioni's wife came in for her birthday, and she took me aside and she said, this is the best Italian restaurant in the city. And I said, Italian? Wow, I never thought of it as Italian. But really, that's what we were doing. Taking a roast and serving it and slicing it and putting it in the copper dish and putting it on the center of the table, that was very akin to what you'd find, you know, in Tuscany or something. So yeah, that's where Craft came. That's how it came about. Yeah, I mean, I think the big difference between then and now is now everybody wants to do it very quickly. For me, back then, it was 10 years minimum before you were sous chef, and then 5 years sous chef before you take a chef's job. That was just kind of the trajectory of a career. And nowadays, it's shortcut for a lot of reasons. And, you know, I understand you come out of school with a lot of debt, and you want to make money. And I think sometimes a lot of young cooks make the wrong decisions because of that. But going back to this idea of starting to work in kitchens and actually putting yourself through an apprenticeship, I think that's often lost. That's how I viewed it. You know, I was going to work for 1 year in a restaurant and move on. And what I started doing when I, you know, at Mondrian and then at Gramercy, when I was more involved in the hiring, I would tell someone, listen, come here. I'm not going to ask you to spend a certain amount of time here, but when you think it's time to leave, and I would move people through all the stations, when you think it's time to leave, don't just go off on your own and start looking for a job. Tell me you want to leave. I'll call up my friends. And we actually got to the point where I would call, you know, Eric or Per and say, hey, Eric, I have someone who's really great. They've been with me for a year and a half. They work through all the stations. Do you have anyone? I would, you know, tell these guys, you know, when it's time to go, I'm going to open the door a lot faster than you will. You know, tell me where you want to go. I'll make a phone call and say, I have someone really great. Because we want people that are trained. And so we would do this kind of exchange. It wasn't structured at all, but we did it. And I would do it with Alfred at Gotham and a few other people. And it worked for a while, but then because it wasn't a structured program, it kind of falls to the wayside. But I would still tell, you know, young chefs, and this is how it worked in France. You know, if you couldn't go on in your education, your father would take you to, if you wanted to be a chef, your father would take you to the local restaurant. And if you did a great job, that guy would call the next guy. And then next one, and next one, next one. And that's just how it worked. And I think too often people feel that, oh my God, and it's one either the chef thinks that this person is leaving me and leaving me high and dry and they're screwing me, or the cook feels like they got to do this in secret. Where if this were just more, you know, open, and they would come and say, all right, I've been here a year, I think it's time to go, and can you help me out? And this way, as a chef, I know when you're going to leave. It's not one day you come in and go, I'll give a notice, chef, I'm gone, sorry. So I know when you're going to leave, and I'm going to make sure that you go into a great restaurant, and that I'm calling the chef and saying, hey, this guy's really good, or this woman's really good. And I think that needs to happen more and more. It would benefit, I think, the whole industry. I think the big misconception is that I spend most of my time on TV. You know, when it airs over several months. It takes us 5 weeks, really, to shoot the whole thing. It takes 2 days to shoot an episode. We don't stop. We don't get weekends off. We just blow right through it. And then we go back later and do the finale a couple months later. So a total maybe 6 weeks out of the year. And now that we're doing one a year, that's it. And during that time, I work every other day. Even though it takes 2 days to shoot an episode, I don't do the quick fires for the most part. So it's pretty easy for me to do, and so I don't spend a lot of my time on it. And you know, the other misconceptions that, you know, the sponsors make choices, the producers make choices, none of that happens. I mean, when I agreed to sign on, that was one condition, that I'm not going to be a puppet of a network or something, that we're going to be serious about this and we're going to make decisions. They were like, fine, we don't care. And especially this season, people were so up in arms. I mean, I got hate mail, and you know, I was called a bigot and a sexist and everything else that you can sort of live. I'm not a fan. I don't care who wins. The audience cares. They're invested. I mean, I don't care who wins. You know, for me, it was a challenge. you know, someone came to me and said, we think you'd be great on TV. And I was like, no, I won't. I'm not going to, I don't want to do it. I said no three times and finally came around to it. It was another challenge. I mean, for me, I what goes through my head is, well, if I say no and somebody else does it and it's usually successful, I'm going to feel really bad about that. So I just thought, you know, this sounds, and I knew Project Runway and Project Greenlight that the Magical Elves did. And I was like, all right, you know what? Let me explore this. Let me see. And, you know, from a couple of conversations, and I felt comfortable that I didn't have to be a character. I could just be myself, and that we were going to focus on food. This was about how are my peers going to, look at this. And after the first season, when Daniel Ballou was calling and saying, can I be a judge? I knew we were doing something that was good. But for me, it was a personal challenge. Hey, can I do this? I mean, it was related to food. Other chefs were doing TV. And I was like, let me give it a shot. And, it worked out. I got to say, winning an Emmy was really, really, really cool. And it was the same year I won a Beard Award for Best Chef in the Country. And so the two are actually together. The Beard Award is wrapped around the Emmy and it's sitting on a table somewhere in my house. But I looked at it, are we contributing to the culinary scene? Now, you're going to get some young tattooed chef who just looks at it and goes, this is the biggest bunch of shit in the world. I don't know why anybody does it. Okay, I understand that. I get it. I'm not going to debate that. That's fine. But look what it's done to the general public. I think the general public understands. And I hear this from so many people. Wow, I had no idea it was that creative. I had no idea that someone could just very quickly think about something, create something. And you hear this from a lot of creative people who never understood the process. And so they get to see that process. They get to understand that it's about the ingredients. They get to understand that there's more to cooking than throwing a bunch of things together. There's really a thought process behind it. And so the general public is now much more accepting of that and understands it. So are we doing something that's giving back? Yes, we are. When I hear, a kid, an 8-year-old kid come up to me and say, I used to hate food, and after watching the show, now I love it. I want to be a chef. Great. What's wrong with that? And so it's very easy to knock something once it's successful, but you got to, look at what you're knocking here. And I'm really proud of the show. Is this good or bad for the industry? And I think on balance, it's good. People, they have hobbies. And when you have hobbies, what do? You start learning, usually through magazines, about your hobby. And you start getting more and more involved. And then you start collecting gear. If it's food, you start collecting knives and cookbooks and things like that. Then you start progressing to restaurants and maybe you redo your kitchen and get the big fancy stove or something. Maybe you take some cooking classes. But then you start going to restaurants and you want to know the personalities behind what's going on. So then people start, and I don't mean this in a negative way, they start collecting chefs. They want to know who they are. They want to know the personalities. And that's how food TV started. So I think that's one way of understanding personalities. And then people maybe sometimes focus too much on the personality and less on what's actually happening. If you look at going back to the 80s to now, I think that's kind of what happened. When chefs started stepping out of the kitchen, it didn't happen here. I mean, this happened in France with Paul Bocuse and the Trois Gros brothers. And, one thing that I think people forget when you talk about Nouvelle Cuisine. Well, Nouvelle Cuisine, aside from cooking things less and making everything lighter, it was the first time chefs started plating stuff and creating a personality on the plate. And then once that personality was created on the plate, people really wanted to know who they were. And so this is something that goes back to the great chefs of France. And that just became part of the equation. And it's, I think, maybe more important now than it was in the 80s, but it's definitely become very, very important that people want to know who's behind their food. Then it comes down to what do they stand for? And I think that's what's happening more and more today, especially with young chefs. What do you stand for? What are your principles in the kitchen? Are you buying whole animals? Are you buying organic? Are you, searching out the best? I mean, that's what is really driving, I think, everything now. put it in terms of good for the industry, bad for the industry, I think on balance, what I've done in my career has been very good for the industry and supportive of the industry. And that's all that really matters to me. I think I use my soapbox for good when it comes to issues of hunger and quality and stuff like that. What does the food movement stand for? What do we want? What do we want out of Congress? We don't know. I don't mean that we should go out and that Michael Pollan or Mary Nessel should run for Congress, but I am suggesting that we need to start supporting leaders who are voting for good food policy.
Yeah.
And getting rid of leaders who are not. The food movement needs to move from a social movement to a political movement. And so it's easy to say our political system sucks and it's broken. Yeah, it may, but it's all we have. And so a real byproduct of politics is justice and social justice. So I think that often when we talk about a food movement, hunger is left off of it. If you're going to create a sustainable movement, part of that sustainability has to be affordability and accessibility. And I think people of low income are being left out of this equation. If the movement's only going to produce something that people of means can afford, then we're never going to get anywhere. And so the movement needs to grow up and we need to support each other. When that happens, then we actually, I think, have more of a movement. And when we can actually finally say, what do we want from Congress? What do we want to see our legislators do?